Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
In the past 4 weeks, we've discussed the links of suffering and birth with independent co-arising. Today, we'll work our way upstream to becoming the immediate condition of birth. Because of appropriation, becoming, because of becoming, birth. We become someone of importance, someone of wealth, someone of impeccable taste, someone wise, nice, or cool and casual. We become celebrities, business tycoons, whizzes with a pipe wrench, sports fans, bookworms. We have an irrepressible need to distinguish ourselves than to assert and defend who we think we have become, fearful and desperate if we discover we're not who we thought we were, or if the conditions change on which our personal identities depend. The world around us also assumes a certain form, warm and supportive of our goals, harsh and perilous, full of fellow travelers or full of suckers who don't deserve an even break. Becoming is the most complete manifestation of the human pathology in this life and of the self, and a locus of suffering, struggle, and distress, and the direct condition for continuation of samsara as what we have become is propelled into the next life. Becoming manifests in two aspects. One, the growth or unfolding of the world as it appears to us, and two, the development of a personality within our world. The term for becoming is bhava, often translated as existence. But the continuous growth and reshaping of world and personality suggests something more dynamic than existence. The word bhava is also incidentally used for rebirth. For instance, the sensual form and formless realms mentioned last week are kama bhava, rupa bhava, and arupa bhava, respectively. And rebirth itself is most often called puna bhava. The Pali for personality is sakkaya, which means sat, existing, plus kaya, body, also translated as personal identity, embodiment, simply identity, or perhaps sense of self. A metaphysical or ontological self or soul is not presumed in the Dhamma, rather the very real experience of being someone is a construct based on conditions that are clarified in dependent co-arising. The Pali word for world is loka. This refers to the phenomenological world or world of experience, not to the natural, objective reality, which is far beyond our direct experience. Our world is how natural reality appears to us through direct awareness or through what we presume about it. It has been pointed out that the origin of the word loka actually suggests appearance. The related verb oloketi means looks at, and a related noun aloka means light. In becoming, world and personality unfold in relation to one another. They are mutually conditioning. Imagine a skier, a geologist, and a miner looking at the same mountain. A skier experiences that mountain as slopes, snow, and ski lifts. A geologist as ancient strata thrust up along a fault line. A miner as opportunities for extracting mineral resources. At the same time, how the mountain is experienced is what makes a skier, a geologist, and a miner, a miner. The alcoholic, the unattached young man and the insurance broker will experience a cocktail party differently. An habitually angry personality will experience his world perpetually as harsh, as conspiring to vex effort and blight dream. A kind personality of impeccable virtue will live in a world that is warm, bright, and full of joy. So becoming is the origin of birth. A fundamental principle in Buddhism is that our past deeds, kamma, or Sanskrit karma, whether wholesome or unwholesome, have fruits that are primary determinants of our personality and world, and likewise determine our future well-being or detriment in future lives. Personalized behaviors or practices have a strong influence on the circumstances of rebirth. Predicting just what parts of personality or world in this life become the inclinations and the circumstances after rebirth into the next is, for the most part, obscure in the literature. To begin with, the language of rebirth is largely cosmological and that of becoming psychological. Accordingly, if we have become angry, selfish, deluded people at war with the world in this life, we might expect to be born in a hell realm in the next. Nonetheless, the cosmological language of rebirth often intrudes into the description of becoming in this life. When asked by Ananda to explain the meaning of bhava, the Buddha stated, "The cognizance of sentient beings, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, is established in a lower realm. That's how there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future." And the same passage is repeated as for lower realm, for middle realm, and higher realm. In particular, jhana practiced in this life is described cosmologically as establishing cognizance in a higher realm. In contrast, another passage descriptive of the same thing confines the cosmological language to the next life. "Here, bhikkhus, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, some person enters and dwells in the first jhana, which consists of rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, accompanied by thought and examination. He relishes it, desires it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in it, focused on it, often dwells in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the devas of Brahma's company." Then this passage goes on with equivalent passages referring to the first, second, third, and fourth jhanas with their corresponding jhana factors in different deva realms. The very common intrusion of cosmological language into the context of becoming may derive from pre-Buddhist tradition. Brahmanical ritual sacrifices generally defined a sacred space of ritual reality that was understood to provide temporary rebirth from the profane sphere into the sacred sphere, from which the sacrificer must return at the conclusion of the ritual. Becoming is effectively within the profane sphere of this life, but certain practices, in particular jhana, bring us temporarily into a sacred space with qualities of realms of rebirth. Another way in which the mapping of becoming to rebirth conditions is obscured in the EBT is what I call the sampling problem. Sometimes we read that a single action in one life results in a particular kind of rebirth into a subsequent life. For instance, offering a certain worthy monk alms on a single occasion in one life results in birth into great wealth and riches in the next life. The problem is that we perform hundreds of actions every day. We have to ask which are determinant of future lives and which not. such examples in which rebirth depends on a single karmic action are actually relatively rare in the earliest texts and could well be entirely allegorical, serving to produce an outlook that has the benefit of treating each action as if it alone were to determine your next birth, in spite of its logical flaws. There seems to be liberal hyperbole in the determinism attributed to the rebirth process. And the sampling problem does not go completely away when practices like jhana, or being nice to people a lot, are described as landing us in a corresponding realm of rebirth. For instance, what happens if we spend varying times in each of the jhanas, or if we spend 20% of the time within some jhana and 80% of our lives being mean? Or what if we're nice one quarter of the time but work as an investment banker the rest of the time? The sampling problem suggests that some averaging out must be involved. The most definitive determinant of the condition of rebirth that we can glean from the EBT is the virtue or depravity of the personality. Developing virtue is a primary concern of the Noble Eightfold Path, through which we practice harmlessness, benefit for others, and purity of mind, and through which we reduce greed, aversion, and delusion. Through virtue, we generally find ourselves in heavenly circumstances in this life, potentially extending into a heavenly realm in the next life. More specifically, the Buddha states that the fruits of karmic acts by which we develop these qualities can ripen in this life, in the next life, or in subsequent lives, but the realm of heavenly rebirth is highlighted for most of us as the goal of one's practice in this life. So let's look at the elements of personality. In a story from the suttas, Bhaddiya Kaligoda was often heard by other monks to exclaim, What bliss! Since he had, as a layman, been a king, they did not assume that he was enjoying the delights of the renunciate life, but rather that he was reminiscing about his previous cushy life. Upon word of this, the Buddha summoned Bhaddiya and discovered that the monks were underestimating the level of his attainment. Bhaddiya explained, "Before, when I was a householder maintaining the bliss of kingship, I had guards posted within and without the royal apartments, within and without the city, within and without the countryside. But even though I was thus guarded and thus protected, I dwelled in fear, agitated, distrustful, and afraid. But now, on going alone to a forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty dwelling, I dwell without fear, unagitated, confident, and unafraid, unconcerned, unruffled, my wants satisfied, with a mind like a wild deer. This is the meaning I have in mind, that I repeatedly exclaim, 'What bliss, what bliss!'" What Bhaddiya had left behind is not so different from the things most of us live with day after day and refuse to give up. An asset-laden personal footprint protected by a high-tech security system and with a financial advisor. Although for many of us the threat is not of bodily violence, the consequences are much the same. Our personal footprint, widely understood, defines who we think we are, our personality or sense of individuated personal identity. Our footprint might include assets like this: car, house, boat, stock portfolio, family, dog, friends, social status, education, profession, hobbies, power, influence, sparkling conversation, personal charm, youth, vigor, beauty, sex appeal, intellect, musical talents, political views, daily gym workout, religious convictions. To establish a personality, we appropriate such assets as me and mine. That is, we identify ourselves with such assets. Four kinds of features are distinguished for appropriation: what we desire, our views about how our world works, efficacious behavioral patterns, our views about who we are in relation to our world. Shaping views and behaviors is an apparent need for a coherent and unified concept of the self as a perceptive, needy agent. In the end, it is our footprint that defines us. What most of us fail to notice is that our footprint makes us miserable, a larger footprint even more miserable. There is craving connected with every asset, and we are terrified of losing or failing to attain what is for us at stake. Craving floods our personal footprint, as explained in later talks, and is, as we know, the origin of suffering. The odd thing is that all the while we imagine a larger personal footprint will make us more secure. For the Buddha, bhikkhus, just as even a trifling amount of feces is foul-smelling, so too I do not praise even a trifling amount of becoming, even for a mere finger snap. What is remarkable is that Venerable Bhaddiya had renounced the bulk of his one-time personal footprint, reducing it to that of a wild deer, and was blissful for it. Effectively, this reversed the process of becoming. This is unbecoming, vibhava. The details of this process of appropriation will be described in future talks. Cognition is the process by which we acquire knowledge, or, without presumption of veracity, by which we come to think we know what we think we know. This involves seeing, hearing, perception, conceptualization, attention, reasoning, presumption, inclination, anticipation, and so on. Broadly speaking, we include within cognition our responses to what we think we know, since these are part of the same mesh of conditionality, deciding, intending, planning, and so on, and also emotional responses like desire and aversion, which exert a strong influence on cognition. Dependent co-arising is a process of cognition. It is mind at work. We can think of this process as a continual arising and ceasing of events, of seeing, attending, presuming, and so on. We've seen that our world is the world as we experience it. If we experience something in the world, it is because we are aware of it. Therefore, we can say that the world is a collection of awareness events. If I see a dog, that is an awareness event. If I hear a dog or think about a dog, that is an awareness event. The dog never enters my world except as part of an awareness event. An awareness event has two parts. First, there is awareness itself, which is part of cognition. And then there is the content that that event carries, the dog, which is typically out there. This is why we can say, as in the Dhammapada, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Elements of content are objects. We can also say the event refers to or designates its object. This is how kitchens and tables and food, cats, sofas, and the moon enter our world. Moreover, various events can cohere around some content so that as we run through cognitive events, we also assemble meaningful content, much as putting meaningful words together produces meaningful sentences, or putting jigsaw pieces together produces a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge. In a sense, the content of awareness must be constructed, and if it manages to accurately reflect what is really out there, we might say it reconstructs reality. I'd like to highlight two kinds of awareness events: cognizance and presumption. Cognizance is the master factor of cognition. Other cognitive factors are effectively facets of cognizance. Independent co-arising itself has been equated with cognizance. The objects of cognizance are very rich in content. The dog is not just perceived, it is three-dimensional, alive, and independently existing in the way cognizance is aware of it. Cognizance is vijnana in Pali. Vi means apart, jnana means know. It's a far upstream link, but its relevance flows all the way down to becoming. Presumption is the primary form of awareness. It is uncommon to experience something directly. Rather, we presume it. Cognizance is very presumptuous. The Pali word for presume is manyati, sometimes translated as imagine or conceive, but generally in a self-centered way. I see the cat one moment, the next moment I don't see the cat, but I presume that the cat still exists and that he's behind the sofa, and later I see the cat and I presume it is the same cat. We perceive Fido's tail sticking out from behind the sofa, but we have to presume the dog. The Buddha asked us to be careful with our presumptions. In whatever way they presume, thereby it turns out otherwise. An awareness event is awareness plus content. We might feel inclined to add a third part, the agent responsible for the event, as in, I see the dog. Here's where the Buddha takes great care. We can presume an I, but we cannot experience it directly in any way. Such an agent would be a self. Rain is a water-carrying event, but without an agent to do the raining. This keeps cognition as simple as rain, awareness plus content. We'll stop here for this week. Next week, we'll take up the dynamics by which our world of experience unfolds or grows.